Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 80, section 6, which is old single column, page 894. Okay, the preceding section was wrapping up the primary details about the Andites, you know, going into directly into Europe proper, in other words, mostly going up around the Caspian Sea and westward into northern Europe and establishing the foundations for the northern white race, eventually down the line when they've blended in with the evolutionary stocks there. Okay, and they ended up, there you see that last little paragraph, at 5000 BC. They are kind of going to be playing various elements of the migration relative to that 5000 BC date. Just see how they're commenting about by 5000 BC, the evolving white races were dominant throughout all of northern Europe. So they took that main migration into northern Europe up to that point. Now they want to talk about the Andites getting into southern Europe. And you have to take a little diversion first, because the Nile, in other words, Egyptian civilization, is part of that process. Even though you're going, well, I thought this was about the Occident, why are we talking about Egypt? It may seem a little bit of a non sequitur, but it's setting the stage, I think, as most people understand, for civilization in southern Europe that ends up in Greece and then over to Rome, eventually. The Egyptian civilization is a predicate to that. So that's what we're going to do here, and you'll see that, like I said, that 5000 BC date comes in again. And maybe just remember that part of the relevancy of that is you basically have recorded history starting at 6000 BC, and but there's that final millennium till 5000 BC that is the last bit of kind of really significant human and climatic shuffling. It's relatively set at 6000 BC, but it's very much set as a predicate for how we understand basically where peoples are. What the climate is, at the origins of our conscious history. Okay, so that's why 5000 BC. It's just it's sort of that. Okay, now you definitely can start to think about lining up stuff we're talking about with things in your record. And you've got a lot of the basic details. You might have some issues with dates. you know, a little bit and stuff, but you kind of have the basic idea. So if we talk about things post 5000 BC, if you have any awareness of human history, you'll hear things that you're familiar with. Whereas before that, we're often talking about stuff that just doesn't have any representation in any recorded history at all. There may be some archaeological finds or something with some mystery to them, and you read about that ancient stuff, you go, oh, okay, that's what that's about. But it's just scattered little tidbits. But it becomes quite an extensive record that the revelators don't talk about directly, because we have that, so they don't talk about things that we already have. You know, a very extensive record that you can begin to put in parallel to the various things that they add in to what we have of record. Okay. All right, so that's, I'm just going to get you spun up again. That's the mode we're in. So what about some of those Andites that, remember when we read about where they went in various places? Remember, there was a significant chunk that went over to Egypt. So what about that, that significant fraction of the Andites?
Section 6, the Andites along the Nile. From the times of the terminal Andite migrations, culture declined in the Euphrates Valley, and the immediate center of civilization shifted to the valley of the Nile. Egypt became the successor of Mesopotamia as the headquarters of the most advanced group on Earth. The Nile Valley began to suffer from floods shortly before the Mesopotamian valleys, but fared much better. This early setback was more than compensated by the continuing stream of Andite immigrants, so that the culture of Egypt, though really derived from the Euphrates region, seemed to forge ahead. But in 5000 BC, during the flood period in Mesopotamia, there were seven distinct groups of human beings in Egypt. All of them, save one, came from Mesopotamia.
So you wanted to read two paragraphs at once.
No. Yes, I did. All kind of flowed together.
I didn't even notice the paragraph. Okay, so that first paragraph there. So from the times of the terminal Andite migrations, okay, so everyone remember again, we've said it several times, so you might actually recall what that's referring to. That's the 8,000 to 6,000 BC time period. Remember, we've mentioned it many times when they're heading out on horseback, and it's it's that final big burst coming out of Mesopotamia. So that's what they're referring to there, where in that 8,000 to 6,000 BC range, as they're saying there, culture is declining in the Euphrates Valley. And things are shifting to Egypt. So, in other words, if you study back into the ancient times there in Egypt, you should, in that 8,000 to 6,000 BC range, you should, if you can get the dates figured out properly, you should be able to see the beginnings of something there, of greater substance than what was there for a long time. Because remember, Egypt is one of those areas that was getting Adamites very, very early on, so before there were Andites. So there's been some Adamic blood feeding into there for a very, very long time. But just as we've seen in other places, those final Andite migrations are very much going to take what's in Egypt kind of out of the background, sort of civilizational phenomenon, and into something much more solid. Okay? So, you know, that's what you'd be looking for. I mean, see, and initially, you know, you might just be looking for evidence of that phenomenon, independent of what dates Egyptologists or something, you know, someone thinks, you know, are tied to various things. Because, like I said, there may be date issues. You know, so it's just like when we went through the historical geology papers, and you know, we saw a date issue to a huge degree. The way you see that date issue is you know what we've discovered, you know, say paleontologically or geologically. You know, a certain type of creature coming into existence, or certain significant earth changes. You know that we are aware of that, and you go, oh, and you see the revelators talking about something that sounds a lot like that. And the more you study, it's like, no, they're talking about exactly what we refer to. I've matched up the events. And then I look at the date that the geologists have for that event, and I look at the date that the revelators have for that event, and I notice the dates are not the same. Right? Don't make the mistake that every new reader always does, of going to the dates. You know, go to the event, because it may very well be that humans are a little confused about the dates. You know, we're not talking about something that happened in the 19th century. You're talking about something that you have very sparse records way back, right? Thousands of years ago. You know, don't be surprised if humans haven't figured it out to, you know, the exact moment when a certain event is, you know, they think a certain event happened. So you line up the events, and then you often notice in the book, I think they're trying to either direct me, tell me, or at least hint, because we can figure out some of it ourselves, but they need to hint anyway, that there's an issue with our dates. We have to go back and reconsider our initial assumptions on those. Okay, anyway, enough said about that. For the moment, it'll come up again in a minute here. Okay, so that's what you're looking for, is things ramping down in Mesopotamia, except for, remember, you know, the little pocket of Sumerians down at the very southern part of Mesopotamia, but things ramping down in terms of some sort of a relatively high civilization, ramping down in Mesopotamia and simultaneously ramping up in around the Nile. All right, and then that second paragraph, recall we talked about when the floods were showing up in Mesopotamia, that was that 5,000 BC date again. Right? Like I said, that's going to keep coming up, you know, either between the lines or directly. And so they're saying that the Nile Valley was starting to have some issues a little bit before that. It wasn't as extreme, so that wouldn't have thwarted this transition from Mesopotamia to the Nile. You know, the Mesopotamians would have been used to a fair amount of flood issues, and so they could deal with that relatively manageable phenomenon in the Nile. You know, but they were getting out of a growing, very difficult problem in Mesopotamia. Okay, and
of course, as we all know, the Nile, you know, even when I was a kid, before they built the dams, was
right.
They relied on the flood.
Right, the Nile floods all the time. That's how they would irrigate, you know, right, all along the Nile, all the stuff they're growing. Right, I mean, that's just part of the, you know, we need to, you know, every time it's flooding somewhere on the planet, we need to remind ourselves that we may not want to try to always control and redirect nature. Maybe we should try to work organically with it a little bit more. If an area likes to flood, well, don't build there. Rather than saying, well, I don't care what the earth wants, I'm going to tell it what to do. It's like, well, the earth's bigger than us. It's going to have a tendency to win.
The key to agriculture along the Nile was that the flooding kept the fields fertile each year. Where
right, all kinds of silt would get dumped out into the
soil gets spent.
And yep, very much so. So natural irrigation and fertilization. Okay, so then you can see, but you have a relatively significant stream, coming in there, and then there's the 5000 BC thing again there, but in 5000 BC during the flood period in Mesopotamia. Okay, so, it's, like I said, as it's getting really complicated there in Mesopotamia, they're kind of delighted to be out there. Don't think simplistically about this, that it's sort of like everything is in Mesopotamia, nothing's in the Nile, and just one ramps down and just the other ramps up in a very monolithic fashion. Like I said before, no, remember, for thousands and thousands, right, 30,000 years, people have been trickling over there from Mesopotamia into the Nile. So it's going to be a complex patchwork, and that's what they say there. There were seven distinct groups. See, that's what the but is about. Right? It's not simple. They're coming into a complex setting, but injecting, and we don't, if you notice, they don't explain exactly these last andites that come in, exactly how they relate to all those seven distinct groups. All of them save one came from Mesopotamia. Okay, well, probably the more Nubian group, I suppose, or something, right? No, they're not going to be engaging them very directly, but how much they spread amongst those other groups evenly. I mean, so they're just hinting. There's probably a whole bunch of dynamics that you could then, it would help you interpret the history. And not be confused if, the only thing we've found is maybe one of the groups that didn't get a little bit of a boost. And so we think there wasn't anything very profound happening back then. But if we looked in some other place where one of these other groups was, we would see this impact. They're just explaining. It could be very complicated. You could be easily confused archaeologically. All right. So that's the that's the basic setup. What's some of the details here?
When the last exodus from the Euphrates Valley occurred, Egypt was fortunate in gaining so many of the most skillful artists and artisans. These Andite artisans found themselves quite at home in that they were thoroughly familiar with river life, its floods, irrigations, and dry seasons. They enjoyed the sheltered position of the Nile Valley. They were there much less subject to hostile raids and attacks than along the Euphrates, and they added greatly to the metalworking skill of the Egyptians. Here they worked iron ores coming from Mount Sinai instead of from the Black Sea regions.
Okay. As I already kind of hinted at, they're familiar with river life. So they'll be able to, just kind of step right in and use the same techniques as they developed over thousands and thousands of years in Mesopotamia and transfer them there. And it's very handy that it's, you don't have, raids coming from Arabia as intense as you did in Mesopotamia, not to mention coming down from the northeast, out of what's currently Iran. They talked about you had there in the Euphrates all the time, or in Mesopotamia all the time.
Of course, lest the helicopters jump out of Russia.
I tell you. notice it's the Euphrates, not the Tigris. So it isn't Baghdad on the Tigris. Okay. um, All right. And notice that they made a point. Most skillful artists and artisans, the full spectrum of artificial, right? Actually, you know, doing a full spectrum unnatural, there's a lot of human quality to this. You know, this is a civilization, not just a culture, a different culture. And so, you know, they're not only going to bring concepts of beauty, but very sophisticated architectural ideas with those artisans. You know, high levels of craftsmanship in all sorts of different ways. All right, let's see, what else there? Oh, notice again, we have metalworking. You know, again, it's every time they say that relative to the Andites, it's not like you can go to Wikipedia and say, oh, yeah, look at there. They talk about metalworking way back before the Bronze Age. No, of course they don't, right? You know, so all these times when they're talking about metalworking prior to, say, 3500 BC, right, that's not appreciated by current scientists.
Just so there's no doubt, they specify iron here.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And then I was just going to make that point. And it's obviously not just, you know, gold, say, or copper, you know, but you know, full on iron ore. You know, I suppose it would be hematite. They're probably mining hematite. You know, you've got it related to that volcano. Right over there, Mount Sinai. It'll eventually give rise to the volcano god, Yahweh. But the other kind of interesting thing there is just, you know, that they don't have to go as far, but the very fact that they were going, you know, all the way to the Black Sea, see, to get iron ore before. So it just reminds you of how much commerce and, you know, and transportation and whatnot was going on way, way back when. Again, you know, not very well appreciated just how sophisticated things were prior to 6,000 BC even, let alone, say, you know, 4,000 BC or whatever. Okay. So that's maybe just one other little thing. It is interesting to do a little digging, and you know, you dig around and you can find little tidbits about, oh yeah, there is iron ore in that area of the Sinai Peninsula, you know, things like that. I mean, yeah, even if it isn't something that you know, maybe is being used a lot in modern times. You know, various places in the book, when they say things like that, it's often interesting to just do a little searching on your own and see if there's a historical appreciation of some of those passing comments. Because no matter how much it might seem like just a completely incidental passing comment in the book, like I've said many times, the more you know about a subject, the more you know, you'll go, wait a minute, what? You know, and it's just two words in a sentence somewhere, right, that you don't think anything of if you have no expertise in that area. Now you just take it in stride. But someone who knows about it is, you know, wait, stop everything. What? You know, they've thrown in some really significant little tidbit, you know, in the midst of some sentence somewhere in the book. So there's, you know, I mean, I try my best to have a little bit of a sense, but I'm obviously not an expert in everything under the sun. You know, so I'm sure there's all kinds of things like that I don't even remotely appreciate. You know, one word, you know, that's giving me some huge hint that solves some giant mystery, and you know, that only a few experts in some field are even aware of. So, yeah, it's just the more you know about any given area, there's always you know, deeper depth that you can mine. Pardon the pun here, talking about mining. you know, in some part of the book. Yep.
A lot of sentences back, did you say something to the volcano god?
Yeah, right, Mount Sinai, remember, is, it was a volcano.
And did you say Yahweh?
Yeah, Yahweh is a volcano god.
Okay.
Yeah, the Hebrews god, the god of the Bedouins of the desert, right, was a god of awe, right? He was a volcano god. And over time, that mere volcano god got evolved into the high concept of the god of 2nd Isaiah. Right? The Yahweh of 2nd Isaiah was quite evolved from that beginning volcano god of the Bedouins, you know, that was kind of like Pele, right, you know, or whatever, for, you know, for the Hawaiians. That's what Mount Sinai is all about. And just all of the confusion about exactly what mountain is Mount Sinai or Mount Horeb, there's endless, confusion about that. The very fact that the Rancho book tells you definitively the mountain you're looking for is a volcano that was active in not very distant times, that should narrow it down a bit. Right? It's not that, just that little, hill there. Again, if you're not familiar with, do a little searching for, everyone must know where Mount Sinai is. No, do a little searching. You'll see it's, people have been building monasteries and fancy places on various hills. You know, it's this one, it's this one. It's like, no, it's this one, it's this one. It's kind of like trying to figure out what place in around Jerusalem or something is a fancy place, you know.
We definitely went through that.
A little tour there. Yep. Okay, let's keep going here.
The Egyptians very early assembled their municipal deities into an elaborate national system of gods. They developed an extensive theology and had an equally extensive but burdensome priesthood. Several different leaders sought to revive the remnants of the early religious teachings of the Sethites, but these endeavors were short-lived. The Andites built the first stone structures in Egypt. The first and most exquisite of the stone pyramids was erected by Imhotep, an Andite architectural genius, while serving as prime minister. Previous buildings had been constructed of brick. While many stone structures had been erected in different parts of the world, this was the first in Egypt. But the art of building steadily declined from the days of this great architect.
Okay, so a number of things there. If you know anything about Egyptology, Imhotep and the Step Pyramid, and but you should feel a little tension if you do know anything about it. It's like, I don't know. Wait a minute, they were just talking about 5000 BC. And they're talking about very early. I mean, it seems like we haven't gone way down the road here in time. This kind of feels like maybe they're suggesting that Imhotep was quite a bit further back than the Egyptologists think. Here's an example. Of where. There's a number of spots. They're very, very coy. The revelators obviously weren't allowed to say anything very direct. But there's a number of indirect statements about the sort of accepted Egyptian chronology that put it into question. Exactly when Akhenaten was, for instance. Or, some of those, or here, Imhotep. This feels like we're talking about something further back than the 27th century BC. It seems like it's got to be a little. This is an interesting problem because the Egyptologists are hyper dogmatic. Their assumptions and their dates and stuff are, an absolute religious dogma thing. I mean, they want to just execute anyone who even questions, right? It's absoluteness. And so people from other disciplines and stuff that make findings and go, well, I don't know, this seems to be suggesting maybe that event happened, you know, 300 years before you think it is, you know, burn him, you know, he's a heretic. It's a very difficult area to challenge. They've gotten themselves very set in stone and in control all the areas. I mean, if you want to do any research where they know that you're kind of questioning the dogma, you know, they won't even allow you to do any research there. You know, they control everything with an iron fist. And so
I really think that at the very beginning was a written language. These facts should be written in glass, not stone.
All right, but you know the way humans are. They love to existentialize their thinking. And
there go a bronze fist.
So, but anyway, it's just about every time they talk about ancient Egypt in terms of individuals we know, you know, if you stop and reflect a little bit, it's like, wait a minute, they're suggesting that's a lot farther back, you know. You know, whoever it might be, whatever historical figure, you know, that they mention in the book. So that's just, see, that's something for experts in that field, need to really reflect on the little hints the relevators give and see if they can improve the Egyptian chronology. The other thing that's fascinating about this, is besides the date issue there, is just how, you know, they're directly calling Imhotep an Andite.
And a prime minister.
Right. I mean, we kind of know that. You know, he wasn't, you know, like the Pharaoh person or whatever, right? That, you know, he was the right-hand man. I mean, that's kind of part of the historical record. Okay. But to actually talk about a historical figure, you know, someone who had, well, we know that name, and you know we've got that inscribed on stones. To refer to him as an Andite. Well, then let me just, you know, that seems like tangential, but I mean, Imhotep was such a significant individual.
What did you say?
I'll explain here in a second. Yeah, for the people on the webinar, I'll explain what she said here. Just one second, setting it up. I mean, Imhotep. It was a very significant individual, and they're kind of explaining that by just saying he is an Andite. It wasn't just architecture. I mean, he had a lot of genius. And because of that, as the centuries rolled on, no matter how long ago it was that he actually lived, as the centuries rolled on, you know, he became a larger-than-life mythological figure. You know, kind of like we just read the way Thor did, right? Maybe not quite that, you know, deified, but close, you know, to the point where we have movies in recent times, you know, where you exalt Imhotep into this, you know, some magical, fanciful phenomenon, right? I mean, that's, see, all they have to do is just say he was an Andite, and you go, oh, no wonder, you know, such a mythology could develop where, you know, even in the 21st century, we're still making movies centered on someone named Imhotep, you know, and running off on even more fanciful deification sort of tangents with him. It's like I said, if there's something profound way back, the answer is probably Andite of why it was mysterious, why it was profound. Okay. You know, why he would have all kinds of like medical knowledge and things like this, you know, like he was some, you know, person descended from the heavens or something, you know. And, I mean, there's all this stuff about Imhotep. It's just because he's Anna. But the other thing about that is, about with the date, see, that, just the fact that they're just flat on calling him an Andite, not, you know, an Egyptian, you know, descended down from these times when the literal Andites were coming in. I mean, they're calling him an Andite. So, again, it suggests, you know, I think he's got to be a little further back then. You know, he can't be in there when you know, even from what the revelators tell you, you had all kinds of other people had come in and mixed it up, and you just really didn't have any Andites anywhere anymore. you must be back further. See, that's little things like that that kind of make you suspicious that something's between the lines that an expert might be able to figure out. But, you know, issues like, the first stone structure and stuff like that. You know, see, we basically have that understanding. And, it's a very, very sophisticated site. It isn't just a pyramid. It's a whole subterranean, system and everything. The reason that they're pointing out that it steadily declined from the days of this great architect, you're going, well, what, wasn't there like bigger pyramids or something? Yeah, there might have been a bigger one. But if you could have seen that full complex when he built, right after he built it, I mean, it was probably just magnificent, in quality, see, not necessarily quantity, but it was the quality aspect that, that indicated a very sophisticated mind. Even now, all these thousands of years later, you still have something that you can basically figure out what was there and map out. You can just imagine what it would have been like way back when.
Well, the other thing that's counterintuitive is because you would think evolutionally there would be simple stone structures first, and then something would build up to the most magnificent.
Right.
Rather than right out of the blue.
Right. Yeah.
The most magnificent structure, and then lesser.
Yeah. Right. Like I said, it's the same. See, all you've done is transferred the historical mystery of Samaria over there. We have the same mystery. It appears that everyone was just picking berries, and then one day they built all this architecture and everything in Mesopotamia. Yeah. Right. Like it just magically came from nowhere. The Andites, right? And that very fact that we try to rationalize everything as purely a building up phenomenon, but like Gene was saying, no, there's an awful lot of stuff that was great long ago and declined even before we have any clue, or was declining as we begin to have a clue of things happening back then. We just don't appreciate that. Everything seems to be magically backwards like that. When we assume that everything must be coming from, like I said, just wandering around picking berries, and eventually, you've got New York City or whatever. okay, so Imhotep, pointing out, he was very much a significant individual with a lot of human quality of mind as an artist and an artisan. All right, and let's see, anything else there? Oh, just at the beginning, remember, for those of you who remember the parts of the book about the evolution of religion, they're pointing out just because we're talking about Andites and especially the way we were just talking about them, where you might start putting them way too high on a pedestal. No, they're still plodding along through burdensome priesthoods and all that sort of stuff. It isn't like somehow they're exempt from a lot of that very difficult evolutionary religion process. Yeah.
Well, they also describe him as serving as prime minister. Mm-hmm. Not pharaoh or emperor, prime minister.
Yeah.
What's that indicate?
Well, I mean, again, there's, we know from the historical record that the Egyptians had a complicated system. They just didn't have pharaohs and one pharaoh and a bunch of serfs. There was a whole hierarchy, and there was a whole court, and everything. And he's the chief mucky muck, in the court, right? You can think about the civilization papers and go back and search for prime minister in the book, they talk about how there was an evolution that eventually led to prime minister. That Yeah, so they're using it in that sense. It's not like there was a British Parliament back then. Yeah. Okay, but in that evolutionary sense of what eventually ended up being like a British Prime Minister, that's the relationship he had to whoever the ruler was. Okay, let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? There was one other thing. All this stuff at the very beginning we skipped over. The whole bit about even though they're plodding through the evolutionary religion steps, they're not, they can't magically skip that many steps or anything. But when the Andites came in, they found this hodgepodge where basically every city has its own god. You can't just, make everyone drop their god and replace it by one monotheistic god or something like that. But you can bring some coordination. See, again, just that human quality of coming in there. It's like, okay, we need to organize this. This is just an arbitrary hodgepodge here. Let's get this systematized so we can work together, and our municipal deities aren't dividing us in some insurmountable way. They came in sort of in a top-down way and organized everything and got them working together, sort of getting that evolution from tribe to nation, in place.
How the Catholic religion adopted December 25th as Jesus' birthday, even though it was the first day of Saturday.
There's a lot of things that happen in an evolutionary process, like the way the Catholic Church has assimilated all kinds of evolutionary ideas.
Right.
There's that, but that's kind of the natural evolutionary process in many ways, with very little stop everything. Let's get really above all of this, and let's construct something, by design. That's more what's going on here. That'll come up here in a little bit here in the next section, some of the things you're talking about with the Catholic Church, actually, where you'll see, how a lot of what happened there with the Catholic Church is a little bit different than what we're talking about here, which is very much, you have these sort of more advanced beings coming into a region and kind of doing what the prince's staff does to the evolutionary process. They, injecting in a top-down, big-picture coordination rather than just it's sort of naturally assimilating stuff along in the evolutionary stream. You actually have kind of parents coming in and coordinating the kids, see? Okay.
Yep. Buddhism do that too, and just...
I think I know what you. Yeah, I mean, a lot.
It's not catered; like it forms itself to.
Yeah, I mean, every evolutionary religion, has all of this stuff that it just assimilates from the environment. Something kind of similar to this, though, did happen in China. We're just reading about China. The Chinese were long struggling with. This group has these notions, these theologies, or these philosophies, these theories. This group has these, and it was very difficult to get everyone working together in a big group. So they did sit down, and had some scholars come up with an overarching scheme. Yin and Yang scheme. Those sorts of things, where everyone could see themselves as a particular facet of a bigger, integrous structure, instead of as disjoint peoples. So that's a similar example of people sort of standing above all of the lower beliefs, and looking down on them and figuring out a clever way to coordinate them together, to weave them together, so that they can work as a big group. That is a very similar thing, what happened in China, to what they're talking about the Andites doing here. Yeah. Okay. Anything? No. Okay. All right. Let's see. All right. Let's keep going here.
This brilliant epic of culture was cut short by internal warfare along the Nile, and the country was soon overrun, as Mesopotamia had been, by the inferior tribes from inhospitable Arabia and by the blacks from the south. As a result, social progress steadily declined for more than 500 years.
Okay, so two things there. One, at the very end there, decline for more than 500 years. Notice how, see, that's giving another little hint about the date thing.
It was 5,500. We've been at the 27.
Yeah, right, obviously, right. But you see, also, it's an event. You know, you could look for something in the record that seems to match up with a decline for more than 500 years. And you see they're giving you little hints. It's always kind of frustrating with the Egyptian stuff that they never kind of come out and just give you a date. It's like, give me one date, you know, so I could pin this down. But they won't do it. They give these hints. So there's that. You know, they're kind of giving you a little bit more of the details of the events that you could seek to match up and try to get some dates to. But then the other thing is, and this is something that we're going to see over and over again as we read forward here in this, the rest of this paper, that big theme of genetics, and that every civilization is fundamentally brought down, or you know, declines. I mean, there's lots of reasons, but you know, one common reason, you know, sort of the foundational reason, is bringing in lesser genetics. You know, and no matter how politically incorrect that is today, you know, that is just the always has been, always will be fact of it. You know, and what they're trying to point out here is the what we know of Egyptian civilization and how we think those people were sophisticated, they're trying to hint that, no, actually, if you go further back, those people were actually more sophisticated of mind. What you think is sophisticated is declined from what was sophisticated, you know, before that. Sure, it might be more sophisticated than, you know, someone in the middle of Borneo or something, okay? But still, it, you know, they're trying to, you know, like just talking about Imhotep there, like I said, I mean, they're trying to get you to think not that that was the, like Gene was saying, that's the beginnings of something that was building. No, that's you know, kind of the hallmark of what was before. You know, and kind of look at it again. Right, and it'll probably strike you differently if you think about it that way. It's like, oh, maybe this is something that really harkens to something greater in the past than the mentality that existed when they did the pyramids in Giza. Okay, so that whole issue of you know, we have no idea what kind of quality of mind there was in those Andite peoples. Sure, like I said before, it's not like you're going to find, you know, some sort of fancy high-tech structure from 15,000 years ago, okay? I mean, they didn't have space-age technology. Okay? But, you know, if you took those, the, you know, that genetic type of human and put them into the modern world, right? I mean, they would run circles around anyone alive today. I mean, they would be so much, have so much more potential than we do today. Yeah, a lot higher quality genetics. All right. Let's see. What else we have there? Oh, just, you notice they said cut short by internal warfare. So they tried, like we were talking, to knit them together, but apparently it had limited effect. It didn't hold for very long.
Must have been a numbers thing.
And they, yeah, I mean, there's...
Because if they were that much more advanced, you'd think from a military point of view, they would have been able to beat it, unless it was just a numbers thing.
Yeah, and you've got, there's a lot of numbers, and you just, they aren't as isolated as it would have been convenient, so like they're pointing out there, you start to get people coming in, and you get these people that just can't wrap their minds around the abstractions of higher civilization, and so divisions develop, and it all starts to fall apart. And it's not just the ones coming up from sub-Saharan sort of Africa, like they're saying there. It's also that the same Arab problem that they had in Mesopotamia. Instead of the Arabs going east into Mesopotamia, now they're going southwest down into Egypt and causing problems.
But it was the internal warfare that made them vulnerable to that.
Yeah.
But what strikes me isn't that this was so short-lived, but the second garden was so long.
Yeah.
And stable.
Yeah.
For thousands.
Thousands and thousands and thousands of years, yeah. Yeah. Again, we keep coming back to how... just you have to really tip your hat to what the Adamites and the Andites were able to do in holding their ground there in Mesopotamia for so long, 30,000 years. That's pretty amazing that after all that time they could still send out waves of relatively advanced genetic stock. Again, it reminds you of just how much active defense they had to have. I mean, they just kind of pointed out it wasn't easy there. I mean, there were people constantly. So there was a lot of warfare to maintain that genetics that pure for that long. If they could have built 100-mile-high walls, they would have done it, right? I mean...
Yeah, if they could have gotten through Congress.
That of course is the thing. I mean, it's the more bureaucracy a civilization develops, the more it becomes its own undoing, because there's certain definitive things. Remember, when you read through the evolution of civilization, as soon as humans discovered how effective that one-man leader was, instead of the committee leading the tribe, and especially in warfare. Yeah. But, as soon as you start to get more sophisticated civilization, you get a whole vast bureaucracy that builds up. The Egyptians had huge bureaucracies and everything, too. And that also adds to the decline of the civilization. It starts to get so gummed up and wrapped around the axle with all of its ever more frozen bureaucracies, where you just can't get anything done. The whole establishment thing, right? Like they were mentioning about the priesthood there, right? It's burdensome because it gets so locked in place, can't progress. Right. So, either that civilization declines or something... Some giant rock gets thrown into the pond and disrupts that frozen state of affairs. If you don't get a significant disruption when you have a calcified establishment, I mean, it's just a matter of time before that civilization is gone. It's just, you can't do anything else. Remember, if you're not progressing, you're dying, because the Supreme is not going to wait for you. The Supreme is ever evolving forward. So if you freeze yourself in some bureaucratic, lock or something, right, you're getting left behind and you won't be upheld anymore and you'll collapse. It's just a given. So, that's one of the huge problems that, we face right now, that is not recognized by very many. that, you know, of all the problems that people get their hair on fire about, okay, if you want to be worried about something, that's a serious problem. And, you know, an establishment that is just immovable. all right. Okay, so that's it for the little predicate of the Nile. Now they want to, you know, actually get to the story of feeding Andites into southern Europe. And you can probably already guess, it's like, well, if things are declining in the Nile, even though kind of historically we think, no, declining. This is, you're right at the very beginning of what we think is the civilization of the Nile starting up. It's like, no, in terms of an Andite quality, it's declining. Okay, and if it declined in Mesopotamia and shifted over to the Nile, if it declines in the Nile, it's probably going to shift somewhere else. Where is it going to go? That's what our next section is about.
Section 7, Andites of the Mediterranean Isles. During the decline of culture in Mesopotamia, there persisted for some time a superior civilization on the islands of the eastern Mediterranean.
Okay, I'll explain the details here in a second, but again, it's kind of like what I said back with Egypt, right? This is an area that's pretty close to Mesopotamia, so, you know, going all the way back to 35,000 BC forward, you would have had Adamites and then Andites, you know, not to mention Nodites, trickling into that region. Okay, so you know, there's going to be some predicate there in the Aegean, but it's about to get the big booster shot. You know, it's like we were talking about with Egypt. Only it's a little bit, there's a definitiveness there that Egypt didn't have, as well. They're about to tell you here.
About 12,000 BC, a brilliant tribe of Andites migrated to Crete. This was the only island settled so early by such a superior group, and it was almost 2,000 years before the descendants of these mariners spread to the neighboring isles. This group were the narrow-headed, smaller-statured Andites who had intermarried with the Vanite division of the northern Nodites. They were all under 6 feet in height and had been literally driven off the mainland by their larger and inferior fellows. These emigrants to Crete were highly skilled in textiles, metals, pottery, plumbing, and the use of stone for building material. They engaged in writing and carried on as herders and agriculturalists.
Okay, so, yeah, even plumbing, right? You know, we think of how recent we think plumbing is. It's like, no, yeah, okay, the Andites had plumbing way back. Just like, again, metals, right? Not to mention textiles and so all of these you know, arts and crafts. See, and here, you know, you've got Crete sitting there, right, out in the Mediterranean. And so if you put some Andites out there, even way, way, way back, you know, they can kind of maintain quite a bit of integrity because they don't have immediate land connections where people are trickling in from other areas and you know, diluting that Adamic blood so immediately, like was happening in Egypt. So, you know, and you can see this. We can tell that there were, you know, as they say, anatomically modern sorts of humans back on Crete, 12,000 BC. And see, that's who they were, right? They were those Andites that came in there. And they basically stayed there before they drifted northward into the other islands of the Aegean for 2,000 years. Right? And we read about this way back in paper 77. Let me just remind you. I'll read that. This whole bit about the Adamsonites. Remember when we were talking about that area by the Caspian Sea, where Adamson went, Adamson Rada started the Adamsonites. It said back there, in these highland sites, situated in a narrow and ancient fertile belt lying in the lower foothills of the Copet Range, you know, to the southeast of the Caspian Sea, there successively arose at various periods four diverse cultures, respectively fostered by four different groups of Adamson's descendants. It was the second of these groups which migrated westward to Greece and the islands of the Mediterranean. See, so we're finally picking up that loose end. And then the third and fourth ones were, see, the residue of Adamson's descendants migrated north and west to enter Europe with the blended stock of the last Andite wave coming out of Mesopotamia. So the third group kind of, you know, followed along over to Europe around the Caspian Sea. And then the fourth is, and they were also numbered among the Andite Aryan invaders of India. I remember when we read about the Aryans coming into India in the middle of the third millennium BC. Okay, so that was the fourth and the last out of there. So we're finally picking up that loose end of that second culture that was, or civilization that was there, stemming from Adamson and Rada. And that, you know, they beelined over there to Crete. Set up shop for a long time before they did anything else. And notice they throw in, okay, you've got the narrow-headed because of the Adamites and the Nodites. Okay. Not much Andonite, broad-headed Andonite blended in. You go, well, wait a minute. I thought these were, you know, there were a lot of Andonites. Well, you remember that, you had some Andonites there to start with, but you also had some Nodites that you know, later came up and joined the crew there. And those Nodites, those 300,000 years when they were plugged into the life circuits and all that, and their genetics was morphing to be kind of like Adamic genetics, they actually went from broad-headed Andonites to long-handed, you know, like Adamites. And so you've got that, but they are smaller statured from the Andonite. It can remind you that the Nodites would have, you know, been a little bit shorter statured, you know, probably. And you have that, I've said this before, kind of a rule of thumb, except for giant strains. In general, if you've got people more than 6 feet, you've got Adamic blood there. Yeah. Now, Red Man was the tallest of the Sangiks. Okay, so that would be, you know, pushing up in contrast to that. But, you know, Red Man is out of the picture over in North America, right? All of these other evolutionary peoples are short relative to the Adamites, you know, and then the Andites, unless there's a bit of shorter stock blended in, like they're pointing out here. That's why you have taller than 6 feet, you know, not that uncommon in Northern Europe. Okay. I'm taller than 6 foot. Guess what? My heritage is from Northern Europe. Like I said, except for the giant strains there in Africa with Green and Orange Man, that's, they're giving you that basic rule of thumb there. Did you have something?
Yeah, I had a question. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, when you mentioned a minute ago, read the other part about the tribes coming over. This is said this is the only island, so they all, and the other part you read, that they went to the island. So I guess this particular brilliant tribe, how many would you guess members would be in a tribe?
You'll get it.
I don't think of that many.
Two paragraphs here, we'll get an idea of how many. Yeah, they're going to tell us a number.
I see it.
To your question coming up here shortly.
Thousands.
Right, there, yeah, we're talking about relatively small groups, yes. You know, you can just imagine, I mean, they all have to, you know, get over there with on boats, right? So we're not talking about millions of people, you know.
Are they riding their horses to over there?
Not across the Mediterranean. But you know, remember the horse was later on than 12,000 BC. So,
that's what I thought.
Yeah. So initially, no, they wouldn't have horses.
So it takes a while.
Let's see here. Okay. Let's see. I think we got everything there, didn't we? There's all kinds of these details here. I think everyone's familiar with, you know, like Minoan civilization with Crete. I mean, everyone knows that. There's some very ancient civilization there in Crete. But again, like Mesopotamia, Egypt, you know, little do we know just how far back it really goes because of the Andites. There's significant stuff a lot farther back than the Minoan civilization. Okay, keep going.
Almost 2,000 years after the settlement of Crete, a group of the tall descendants of Adamson made their way over the northern islands to Greece, coming almost directly from their highland homes north of Mesopotamia. These progenitors of the Greeks were led westward by Sato, a direct descendant of Adamson and Rata.
Okay, so they're... Right, so there are some taller ones that are going to come over, kind of give you that, you know, they're trying to explain these differentials that archaeologists, historians, you know, appreciate about, you know, what went on there in the Aegean region, that you have these. Different height stocks. So again, it's kind of little details like that for the experts. You know, you can just, you know, now I'm understanding it. They're just trying to give little tidbits to help out the scholars in those particular areas. Okay. By tall, obviously they told you. In other words, these are going to be, you know, a lot of people taller than 6 foot, what they mean by tall. The fact that, yeah, and then someone I heard say Sato there, yeah, another example where they throw out a name like that, right? And they do it all over in the book. It's like, let me just toss a name, you know, you're left wondering, do you suppose we can find that somewhere, or what's the deal with that? But, it's kind of interesting that they don't just throw out the name, but they tell you he's a direct descendant of Adamson and Rata. So that's a curious little addition, too, that seems to be hinting that there's something to be discovered and properly interpreted because they give you that little tidbit. All right.
The group which finally settled in Greece consisted of 375 of the selected and superior people comprising the end of the second civilization of the Adamsonites. These later sons of Adamson carried the then most valuable strains of the emerging white races. They were of a high intellectual order and physically regarded the most beautiful of men since the days of the first Eden.
Okay, so certainly a lofty description of those peoples. Not surprising that the peoples of Greece might have some pretty grand thoughts about their ancestry, obviously.
Women were not bad looking.
Yes, right. It's, yeah. In other words, they were all very statuesque and striking, see? Yes. And John's question, you know, is he just 375? Right. But they're creme de la creme genetically. No qualification. The then most valuable strains. So all of those Andites, vastly greater numbers than we're talking about here, lots and lots of Andites, streaming in and setting up the northern white race. Yes, but none of them were of this high a quality. So no wonder, Western civilization has its roots there in Greece and, not in Denmark. Yeah. Again, it's all about that genetics. A little bit of advanced genetics goes a long ways. if there wasn't these 375 individuals, would we even be sitting here as, sort of the advancing edge of Western civilization talking about this right now? you really have to wonder, see? How would it have played out but for 375 select individuals getting things going there in Greece? And interesting to think about. All right.
Presently, Greece and the Aegean Islands region succeeded Mesopotamia and Egypt as the occidental center of trade, art, and culture. But as it was in Egypt, so again, practically all of the art and science of the Aegean world was derived from Mesopotamia, except for the culture of the Adamsonite forerunners of the Greeks. All the art and genius of these latter people is a direct legacy of the posterity of Adamson, the first son of Adam and Eve, and his extraordinary second wife, a daughter descended in an unbroken line from the pure Nuddite staff of Prince Galligastia. No wonder the Greeks had mythological traditions that they were directly descended from gods and superhuman beings.
As I just said a moment ago, yes. Pretty obvious.
When they told us about Radha,
I knew you'd bring that up.
It wasn't this definitive.
Right. Yeah, remember, we kind of talked about that. See, it is, it is definitive, right? Let's see, what else did we have there? I remember his first wife and all of his kids, jumped on the seraphic transports or on a dentia. Yeah. Yes, left him all alone.
Makes me feel better.
You see they're already hinting at, like I said, this whole transference. They'll talk about it more directly here in a second here, but how when all is said and done, it's going to be in Greece for the center, not Mesopotamia or Egypt. Let's see, anything else there? All the art and science. Notice they throw in the word science there. That should strike you again. We're not talking about extremely primitive. I mean, they're sophisticated enough that there's some aspect of their thinking that's worthy to be called science. Yeah. That they're pursuing knowledge. They aren't just satisfied with believing whatever they're genetically inclined to believe. All right? They have the courage to challenge those genetic belief tendencies and are trying to seek for objective facts and objective knowledge. Not just information that is rationalized in the favorite way of the day, which is what's begun to happen now, and we don't really have science much anymore, right? Because we're not really seeking knowledge anymore. We're just collecting data and rationalizing it in our most pleasant way.
I was thinking today about what you said about so-called religion and so-called science.
Mm-hmm.
In a so-called religion, you believe first and then rationalize your belief.
Mm-hmm.
The so-called science, you rationalize first and then believe.
Mm-hmm. Your rationalizations, yeah.
Your rationalization. Yeah. Well, what's going on today in the so-called science? They're taking this belief, really, and then rationalize it. It's really a religion.
Yeah.
Religious thinking, it's not science.
Yeah, yeah, and the Revelators actually bring that up.
In a so-called sense.
Yes, exactly. and the Revelators kind of point that out, that, you know, it's first it's so-called science, and then it's evolutionary religion again. See, and that's the thing. I mean, a lot of what's called science now isn't even so-called science. It's just primitive evolutionary religion. You know, with fancy blinking lights and stuff tied to it, you know, so we think it's science. Science means knowledge, yes. In Latin, yes, that's what the word science means, is knowledge. See, and scientists, try to find a scientist that can explain the difference between information and knowledge so that he can demonstrate he's actually a scientist.
Yeah.
A pursuer of knowledge and not just a gatherer of data.
Or facts. Or
information. See, you know, they just information. Data, information. Right?
That's not facts, is it?
No, not necessarily, you know. Right? It's just data. What they call science, you know, if it isn't totally just kind of just evolutionary religion, like Gene is saying, if they're still kind of rationalizing first and believing second, right? I mean, it's just data collection and analysis followed by a rationalization predicated on you going, well, what's the framework? What's the initial assumptions? Yeah, see, that's the problem. Yeah, what are those initial assumptions based upon? Like I was saying, as this conversation started, see, that's the whole thing. They're by saying science here, they're telling you these people have recognized that you have an initial tendency to pull a certain initial assumption out of thin air. And base all of your rationalizing on that, you know, just because of nature and nurture, you have a certain tendency, you know, for a starting point that feels comfortable, and everything is rationalized, predicated on that. But these people obviously know that that's the subjective tendency, and they're working against that. It's like, okay, I'm not just going to start with what feels comfortable to start with for an initial assumption. I'm going to try to find an objective initial assumption where I don't have anything to do with it. It just is. It's not what I desire, not what I, you know, long for, my fondest hopes and dreams or whatever. It just is. And I have to accept that. And that's the initial assumption. And I rationalize predicated on that objective initial assumption. And so then my understanding, see, you know, leads to knowledge. Right. Knowledge of the facts, the objective facts, right? And not just a favorite rationalization of the appearance, right? But a knowledge of reality.
What's the difference between data and facts?
Well,
you just fell into that trap. One proves the other.
We're getting off into some abstract space here, but. The fact is tied to knowledge, and I mean, it's not just the immediacy of what you measure, but the concept of recognizing it as a fact means that you've put it into an objective context. A fact isn't something that a machine collects, you know, the device collects. a human reflecting upon data comes to determine, you know, what's factual about what's been collected. See, I mean, it's a subtle abstract thing. Yeah, it gets into. We could go on forever trying to explain it, but just again, it's tied into that reflecting on what's the difference between information and knowledge.
It's almost like the shooting
sheet
model.
You know, the device gathers information, data. It doesn't gather knowledge. Right? And facts are the nuggets. See, the conceptual nuggets of knowledge. Fact, truth, goodness, for instance, that triplet right here, right? Fact is individuality, truth is associativity, goodness is unity. See, obviously, fact must be referring to an individuality, like I was saying, a nugget. See? A nugget in a knowledge system. An individuality point in a knowledge system.
Something that could be a part of a whole, a data point.
Right. See, that's what I say. I mean, to call something a fact is to say that you have it placed in a context, an objective context. You know, facts don't just sort of float, you know, abstractly unto themselves. You know, any more than knowledge is just something that's floating out there that you can, you know, gather with a net. Yeah. You can gather data with a net. Okay. Okay, meanwhile, back to Adamson and Rada and such things. Let's see. So we did, let's see. Did we get everything in that paragraph? Let's see. Yeah, we did that. Yeah, I think we got everything there. Okay, keep going.
The Aegean region passed through five distinct cultural stages, each less spiritual than the preceding, and ere long the last glorious era of art perished beneath the weight of the rapidly multiplying mediocre descendants of the Danubian slaves who had been imported by the later generations of Greeks.
There it is again, the same issue. If it isn't kind of inescapable, people, you know, encroaching on a space of lesser genetics, you know, they're being brought in purposely as slaves, and then like I said many times, the sex hunger being what it is, things happen. Yep.
The Danubians, they speak of Slavs.
No, we'll get to the Danubians here in a second. What they mean by Danubian slaves. That's the next section. Okay, so, and the other thing there is each less spiritual. Okay, and here's a great opportunity to not think what everyone thinks when they hear the word spiritual, but to think what the revelators want you to think. Each less woo-woo. No, that's not what they're talking about. Again, just think about the hourglass analogy of your mind or self. Right? The upper domain, the personalized self, is spiritualized mind. That's what they mean. You know, it's less and less personal, creative, original, more and more fancy animal. Less and less top-down, more and more bottom-up. That's what's happening. That's what, you know, those Andites had is a lot more spiritualized mind. So there's just so much more potential for creativity, originality, right? If you gave them the current context, technological context, wow, you know, would they have insight? You know. Whereas we're all just staring at it, I don't know. Right? They would have insight. But if you put someone with a lot of potential like that in a limited environment, you know, okay, there's no stimulus, right? So their potential doesn't get actualized, right? Or it gets actualized just to the degree that it could back in 12,000 BC or 6,000 BC or whatever. But just, you know, don't judge it by what actualizes based upon environmental stimulus. You know, judge it by its potential, what it could be in a stimulating environment. Like what you will be if you put you on the first mansion world instead of on a benighted sphere. Right?
So when I'm talking about less spiritual, so I would imagine, when, you know, when I talked about the history of the advent of thought adjusters, and, you know, and how they come before,
right.
You know, they're bestowed because of the spirit of truth, that, you know, quite a few of these people probably did not receive thought adjusters, and let, you know, this as it become less and less spiritual.
Yeah.
And that in itself would also help, I would think, in terms of having a thought adjuster and being able to have, you know, to upstep, you know, whatever deficiencies they may have.
Yeah, remember what they said about Cain, you know, the fact that he had an adjuster, right? I mean, it just gave, you know, it's not like he's talking to his adjuster and, you know, the adjuster is telling him what to do and so he could, you know, run circles around everyone around him. It's not like that. It's just, you know, there's a stimulus in his spiritualized mind, you know, in his personalized self, where it's, see, like I said, I mean, that personalized self gets actualized by a stimulus, and that can be an external stimulus or an internal stimulus from your adjuster. But either way, it needs to be stimulated, you know, for that potential to actualize. And so someone like Cain or any of these people that had adjusters, right, have that additional stimulus. But as it declines, since we're talking pre-Pentecost, you're going to have more people that don't naturally have adjusters. Right? I mean, you definitely could have people that aren't coming from a line where, you know, the parents had adjusters, so the kid had an adjuster, so, you know, the grandchildren have adjusters, you know. You know, there's lines that are broken for various reasons, and so, yeah. As we always talk about, we have no idea what the percentages were or anything. You can only speculate, like how many people in Jesus' audience had adjusters, you know, or things like that. But nonetheless, right, you can definitely assume that whatever the percentage is, it has to most likely be declining, you know, if they're quote-unquote less spiritual. Yep. Okay.
It was during this age in Crete that the mother cult of the descendants of Cain attained its greatest vogue. This cult glorified Eve in the worship of the Great Mother. Images of Eve were everywhere. Thousands of public shrines were erected throughout Crete and Asia Minor. And this mother cult persisted on down to the times of Christ, becoming later incorporated in the early Christian religion under the guise of the glorification and worship of Mary, the earth mother of Jesus.
And so there's your, you know, your Catholicism assimilation that we were talking about a while ago. You know, the Revelators, for those of us who are familiar with the book, know that this is a cool thing that the Revelators give us about the Great Mother, you know, the mother cult that was so popular, you know, in the Mediterranean region back in, you know, in historical times, that goes back to Adam wasn't Cain's father. You know, the Nodites kind of got a problematic reputation in the wake of the default, right? And so, you know, in relative terms, Eve gets all the more exalted, you know, as a historical figure. And so as you go forward in time, you know, she just gets more and more exalted, the great mother of Cain, Eve, until, you know, she becomes a deity, you know, in people's schemes. You know, that's where the whole mother cult comes from, is the fact that only Eve was you know, it was an Adamic parent to Cain. And, you know, you can see how thousands of public shrines, I mean, like I said, I mean, it was super, super popular, you know, all the way up to 2,000 years ago, you know, at the time of Christ. You know, it was, you know, assimilating that into the Christian church was an important way that you assimilated men and women together in a common religious phenomenon. You know, they were very much apart, like with, at the temple, right, with the Jews, right? Men and women weren't really treated together in some sort of an equal sense. So bringing the mother cult in, you know, by exalting Mary was, you know, you just, oh, we know who the, you know, the great mother is. It's Mother Mary. And it's just, you just take all of the rituals and the appeal of women to the mother cult and you just assimilate that into the Catholic Church and you go forward with both men and women.
That's, you know? That's why Paul didn't like the Cretans.
Yep. Mary of I don't know what.
Right, and, yeah, and then as you go forward, there's other, you know, mother cult things, you know, even in the New World that, you know, get modified. And, you know, the Catholics come in and say, oh, you know, that great mother you exalt, that's the Mother Mary, you know, and so, right, you know, everything of a mother flavor in anyone's evolutionary religion gets turned into Mary. And assimilated into the church.
And then here comes the Urantia book with a whole other mother.
Yeah. Throw milk, soda, and tea in one cup. It doesn't usually taste that. We're gonna
try it. They're indicating here that Cain wasn't just a flash in the pan. You know, that mm-hmm. there is an ongoing influence.
Oh, yeah.
And it was really somehow carried through by the mother rather than father dominant, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, is it, you know, what they're pointing out, at least religiously, you know, him going over there with the Nonites and becoming a great leader and all of his, you know, descendants being leaders, you know, after him, established this very definitive mother bias in the religiosity of those people, you know. Yeah. All right, let's keep going here.
By about 6500 BC, there had occurred a great decline in the spiritual heritage of the Andites. The descendants of Adam were widespreadly dispersed and had been virtually swallowed up in the older and more numerous human races. In this decadence of Andite civilization, together with the disappearance of their religious standards, left the spiritually impoverished races of the world in a deplorable condition.
Okay, so that's an interesting. They've thrown in something. They haven't quite given us that twist. That, we have pockets, you know, but they're kind of giving you kind of the overall picture that in that 8,000 to 6,000 BC range, of those last migrations. There's a definite decline in quality here, you know, so that even before you get to 6,000 BC, by about 6,500 BC, that, you know, as we were just talking about, you know, you might say the religiosity of these peoples is, you know, pretty primitive. Okay, you've kind of lost all sight of what the Sethite priesthood had tried to do in maintaining a little higher quality of religious concepts. Remember, they even mentioned that, where was that, back here, about several different leaders sought to revive the remnants of the early religious teachings of the Sethites, but these endeavors were short-lived. You know, they're in Egypt. Like I was saying, they're just pointing out here, that's kind of everywhere. It's happening everywhere. The Sethite effort has run out of gas. And you're in you're in a lot of need of some sort of a revivification here. Okay, let's see. I guess that's, yeah, that's, yeah. Other than them using very strong words like decadence and deplorable. Wait a minute, deplorable, that sounds familiar. But that's another story.
Gene tried to change the syllable.
and, you know, I'll just, one thing I'll say there, you know, the relativity of using those strong words. It's what we were talking about earlier. To appreciate just what a high quality there was in some thoughts way, 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 way back that was, see, basically gone before the beginning of recorded history. So we have no idea there ever was such quality. You know? That's, you know, they're just trying to remind you of that again. And that, you know, we might in some ways look at what they're calling deplorable and go, well, I don't know, that seems relatively advanced, you know, like I said, compared to someone, you know, in the middle of sub-Saharan Africa or something, right? You know, amongst the pygmies, but, right, it's deplorable relative to the quality of prior Andite, you know, personalized selves of long ago. All right.
By 5000 BC, the three purest strains of Adam's descendants were in Sumeria, Northern Europe, and Greece. The whole of Mesopotamia was being slowly deteriorated by the stream of mixed and darker races which filtered in from Arabia. And the coming of these inferior peoples contributed further to the scattering abroad of the biologic and cultural residue of the Andites. From all over the Fertile Crescent, the more adventurous peoples poured westward to the islands. These migrants cultivated both grain and vegetables, and they brought domesticated animals with them.
Okay, so yeah, it's like I said, see, there's that 5000 BC again. Again, you can just see they're pointing out, you know, that around 5000 BC, you have the final sort of readjustments so that in many ways, evidence of the high quality past has just been erased. By moving people around and stuff, it's like just putting an eraser to everything. And, you know, and it just sort of is what it is with the deplorable condition and whatnot, you know, as we begin our recorded history, and we just don't have any idea of how where people were and, you know, way back when and how high quality their culture was way back then in that place that, you know, now at 5000 BC is totally abandoned, you know, like that whole area around the Caspian, say. You know?
They say about Arabia, you know, we think of Arabia as being so sparsely populated.
Yeah.
If you move them all out, it wouldn't hardly make a dent in you. No, that must have been very much populated one time.
Yeah, not
changing climate pushed them out of that region.
Well, yeah. Plus, you know, it isn't, you know, a lot of it is just in that region in the middle of the Fertile Crescent, you know, between Palestine and Mesopotamia. Right, just, you know, right in there, the Arabians in there,
okay.
You know, not necessarily way out in the desert, you know, to the south. Okay, you know, that's the primary, Arab problem that the Mesopotamians had, is those people just immediately to the west of them and to the east of Palestine. Yeah. Okay, let's see, we got everything there? Oh yeah, up front. So there's all of this decay, but you have three little pockets. I know, like we keep talking about depopulating Mesopotamia, remember the asterisk, yeah, except for the little crew down at the very southern part, the Sumerians. Okay, they're there. You've got what we've put into Northern Europe, and now we have the other element, what we've put into Greece. And so the whole future of civilization is hanging on those three little nuggets. If something, you know, at 5000 BC, if there had been some catastrophe and it wiped out those three little pockets, right?
Does that have anything to do with the title of the next chapter?
So that's, you know, they're just pointing out again, you know, we saw that, what was it, 375 there. I mean, you know, just reminding you of, yeah, you had just Adam and Eve, right, to begin with, and, you know, we aren't that much beyond that. It's still just a fragile little bit. We don't have the millions and millions and millions, you know, that there was supposed to be. So this is a very fragile thing, civilization having any potential on this planet. No wonder you have that line about conserving the higher spiritual types. Yeah. See, again, like we're talking about, right? Not the hopelessly visionary and impractical people. No, the ones that have some significant personalized self of spiritualized mind still, some potential to be creative and original still. And make sure that those don't disappear, because if the salt loses its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? You can't just manufacture Adamic genetics out of nothing. At least you can't right now with what little we know about genetics. Okay, so that's all hanging in this tentative little pocket, these three little pockets.
About 5000 BC, a mighty host of progressive Mesopotamians moved out of the Euphrates Valley and settled upon the island of Cyprus. This civilization was wiped out almost 2,000 years subsequently by the barbarian hordes from the north.
Okay, so what they're going to do here is give you just little vignettes of kind of little side notes. Most of, like we were just saying, most everyone has moved around and is in place. But there's a few little details, right? There's as the last, you know, relatively better quality people are still hanging around in Mesopotamia. You know, they decide to pack up. So you get kind of little just slight additions in some areas. And in Cyprus, you know, it eventually was wiped out. So that's why, you know, we don't have some knowledge of some incredible civilization, you know, on Cyprus. Because the barbarian hordes from the north took them out. It's like, whoa, isn't that like the Romans? Yeah, yes, we always have these barbarian hordes from the north. Okay, so so in other words, you can look in Cyprus and you could find some fancier stuff way back then, but then it would disappear. Yeah, archaeologically.
Jeez, it was a mighty host, and boom, it's gone.
Yep. Okay, what about this other little tidbit?
Another great colony settled on the Mediterranean near the later site of Carthage. And from North Africa, large numbers of Andites entered Spain and later mingled in Switzerland with their brethren who had earlier come to Italy from the Aegean Islands.
Okay, so now that's an important tidbit. So it's, you know, it starts by kind of setting up the predicate for, you know, having Carthage there in Tunisia, you know, right across from Sicily on the northern coast of the Mediterranean there. I mean, the northern coast of Africa, southern coast of the Mediterranean. So, you know, kind of why Carthage? You know, that location is kind of getting a marker put on it here. But then they go around and you go, Switzerland? Well, that comes out of the blue. okay, but see, what you're setting up there, you know, besides the, you know, coming over from Greece and the Aegean Islands, you know, over to Italy, like I think a lot of you probably know, you know, what's happening, and heading north up Italy. what you're setting up, see, they're pointing out, is that very definitive north-south differential in Italy. Huge difference between northern Italy and southern Italy. It's not a coincidence that that Venice is in northern Italy, right? Or Milan is in northern Italy, et cetera. I mean, it has this, this basically this Andite sort of predicate to it, see? And so you're going to, even though you have all those Andites that went into northern Europe, there's going to be a tendency for them to be coming down, through Germany and France, around the Alps and up and kind of linking in with these peoples that are there. And so kind of having a little bit of kind of that northern European sort of aspect to northern Italy there. And that'll come up in the last section of this paper here. But that's they're explaining what the main reason why it is that you didn't just have this southern white race kind of just filling in evenly over all of Italy. How did you end up with this guy, north and south China, north and south India, north and south Italy, same sort of differentials? They're trying to explain that.
Okay. They're indicating these Andites from Carthage, though, rather than crossing the Mediterranean, that they went by land.
Yeah, they went around. Yeah.
And crossed at the Strait of Gibraltar through Spain.
Right. Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And wrapped around. And so, so you're also going to be feeding a little bit of, they aren't all just going to end up there in northern Italy. You'll have blended in a little bit of genetics into the southern Europeans, right, of a little higher quality. Okay.
When Egypt followed Mesopotamia in cultural decline, many of the more able and advanced families fled to Crete, thus greatly augmenting this already advanced civilization. And when the arrival of inferior groups from Egypt later threatened the civilization of Crete, the more cultured families moved on west to Greece.
Right, so there it is. Like I said, I told you it was coming up, where they literally talk about it. So we go decline in Mesopotamia, increase in Egypt, decline in Egypt, increase in Crete, decline in Crete, increase in Greece, decline in Greece, increase in Rome. Right, until eventually it ends up, in Colorado. Right? It just, right? that's what's going on. And here, of course, you can, there's going to be this little bit more significant, more ancient predicate in Crete, like they're pointing out, but you should be able to match this up. There should be a point where you can figure out, okay, here's when you got this boost in Crete. Okay, well, that must mean that fancier stuff in Egypt was before that, right? And if you can't quite date the stuff in Egypt, you could date this immediately subsequent stuff, boost in Crete, and you go, whoa, that means that Imhotep was a lot farther back than we think. See, again, it's those clues that they're giving like that to try to help you sort out the dates on all this stuff. Let's see. I think that was everything there. Other than, you have many of the more able and advanced families fled to Crete, and then you have the more cultured families moved on west to Greece. It's the cream, but the cream is diminishing. Okay.
The Greeks were not only great teachers and artists, they were also the world's greatest traders and colonizers. before succumbing to the flood of inferiority which eventually engulfed their art and commerce, they succeeded in planting so many outposts of culture to the west that a great many of the advances in early Greek civilization persisted in the later peoples of southern Europe. And many of the mixed descendants of these Adamsonites became incorporated in the tribes of the adjacent mainlands.
Okay, yeah, so I see them hinting about the shift over to Rome, obviously. You know, not to mention, how they extended out in that whole region a little bit and gave it some boost to civilization around there. Okay, so now the Danubian Andonites. Let's get this little footnote in here. Who are we talking about here? Remember, I told you that they have been hinting at this, that we've got a lot about how we get the southern white race and about the northern white race. What about the central white race? What fundamentally makes it distinguished from the others? That's what we're going to talk about here.
8, the Danubian Andonites. The Andite peoples of the Euphrates Valley migrated north to Europe to mingle with the Blue Man and west into the Mediterranean regions to mix with the remnants of the commingled Saharans and the southern Blue Men. And these two branches of the white race were, and now are, widely separated by the broad-headed mountain survivors of the earlier Andonite tribes, which had long inhabited these central regions.
Okay, see, so there, the title tells you, you know, who are these Danubians? Okay, they're Andonites. And as they're just saying there at the end, they had long penetrated into central Europe, going up the Danube Valley. Right, it cuts through the middle of Europe there, east-west, you know, basically through the middle of Europe. So that's the deal. You've got these broader-headed Andonites in there. They, you know, as we've seen a lot of times with the Andonites, they get pushed around a lot by the other peoples, by the Sangiks and the Andites and whatnot. But in a lot of places, they end up finding a region that no one really cares that much for, and so they actually stay there a long time. There's a lot of these more alpine regions in Europe that everyone else is like, not really that interested. And so they could kind of just be there and stay there and for a long time, relatively unassailed. It's not like the Andites and the Blue Men, where the Andites sort of just, you know, went everywhere in Europe and either killed or assimilated Blue Men until there wasn't any Blue Men left. There's a lot of Andonites, so they just sort of let be. See? They didn't feel threatened by them or anything, see? And so you end up with, you know, a lot of, you know, relatively pure Andonite blood that's going to get blended in, you know, and have a predominance in some areas, at least, you know, a few thousand years ago in Europe. Okay.
These descendants of Andon were dispersed throughout most of the mountainous regions of central and southeastern Europe. They were often reinforced by arrivals from Asia Minor, which region they occupied in considerable strength. The ancient Hittites stemmed directly from the Andonite stock. Their pale skins and broad heads were typical of that race. This strain was carried in Abraham's ancestry and contributed much to the characteristic facial appearance of his later Jewish descendants, who, while having a culture and religion derived from the Andites, spoke a very different language. Their tongue was distinctly Andonite.
Okay, so that's a paragraph giving all kinds of fun little tidbits for various scholars in various areas, clearing up mysteries. First of all, for whatever reason, you had a predominantly Andite civilization, you know, holding a lot of Asia Minor, you know, current Turkey, for a long time. And so, you know, you can just picture them, you know, trickling up into southeastern Europe and going up the Danube and penetrating way into you know, all the way over to you know, eastern France and Belgium. Okay, so that's the deal. You got these Andonites, you got this kind of pool there in Asia Minor, and there, and for a long time they penetrated in and continued to penetrate in. And that gets you to the Hittites. You know, so when you're talking about those civilizations like the Assyrians and, you know, and what have you there in the Near East, that's the deal with the Hittites, is they have a lot more of an Andonite rather than Andite sort of civilization there in Asia Minor. And, you know, and that gives you that whole wonderful tidbit about Abraham and the Jews. And then, you know, we all know how compelling and dominant the culture and religion, you know, the Andites was relative to more primitive things. So you have that definite influence. But like with language, you know, the Hebrew language, you know, the Hittite, you know, the extinct Hittite language, to give you that little tidbit that's Andonite. That Anatolian or, you know, or Hittite language, the scholars, you know, they basically try to rationalize it as an Indo-European language. But a few of them that are honest with themselves feel an uneasiness about it, that it feels too rationalized, you know, and they're thinking maybe it isn't really an Indo-European language. See, and the rabbis are saying, yeah, you should be suspicious. And it's like, well, why is it that some seem to be able to, you know, with a lot of hand-waving, rationalize it into Indo-European? Well, having a culture and religion derived from the Andites, right? See, there's all kinds of cultural influence, right, to modify the language. But they, you know, the reason the root is so not Indo-European feeling to the honest scholars is because it's not Andite; it's Andonite. So they're explaining a long-standing mystery there. All right.
The tribes that dwelt in houses, erected on piles or log piers over the lakes of Italy, Switzerland, and southern Europe, were the expanding fringes of the African, Aegean, and more especially, the Danubian migrations.
So there's obviously just an obvious little hint, you know, for the archaeologists there. I don't think we need to really explain that much. Okay.
The Danubians were Andonites, farmers and herders who had entered Europe through the Balkan Peninsula and were moving slowly more northward by way of the Danube Valley. They made pottery and tilled the land, preferring to live in the valleys. The most northerly settlement of the Danubians was at Liège in Belgium. These tribes deteriorated rapidly as they moved away from the center and source of their culture. The best pottery is the product of the earlier settlements.
Again, a lot of details, see, for the archaeologists, and you know, pointing out that when you get all the way to the headwaters of the Danube, you know, they penetrated a little bit beyond that. You know, over you know, they'll tell you later, a little bit over into eastern France and even up into, you know, what's currently Belgium now. But pretty much kind of just going up to the end of the Danube and flaring out a little bit off the end, and that's it.
Don't you think they're calling them Andonites, but aren't they most likely up steps quite a lot from earlier?
Yeah, and great that you mentioned that. That tees up what I just, as you were reading, I was like, oh, wait, I forgot an important point in that paragraph back there, that second paragraph in the section, where it said... that the Hittites, ancient Hittites, stem directly from the Andonite stock. Their pale skins And broadheads were typical of that race. You go, well, wait a minute. Okay, they got the broadheads of the Ananites, but what about swarthy? You know, pale. Ah, he's got to be Nodite blended in, see. So enough Nodite to actually dilute them down to relatively pale skin.
And make them more of a ledger.
Okay, but still broad-headed because of, an extensive Andonite. That's a little tidbit. It's that the Nodites not only went from broadhead to longhead, those 300,000 years of mutation, but they actually went from swarthy skin to pale skin, like Adamites. So there's a pretty much, see, on the surface and all the way inside, I mean, they're morphed into, a quasi-Adamite.
A lot of compensation for the Adamites that went off planet.
The fact that we lost a whole bunch of Adamites, like we've pointed out, it's handy that we had Nodites, including obviously quite significant Nodites like Radha.
Yeah.
You can tell the way they just described her, right? I mean, it's six of one, half a dozen another between her and Adamson.
If you're looking for a female to exalt, you might want to think about Radha.
Yeah, she was high quality genetics. They're pointing out, they're just coming out of Asia Minor and streaming up the Balkan Peninsula there, and then getting to the Danube and following it deeper into Europe. And all those kind of archaeological details about pottery and what have you there too, to help out the scientists. Okay, final little paragraph here.
The Danubians became mother worshippers as the result of the work of the missionaries from Crete. These tribes later amalgamated with groups of Andonite sailors who came by boats from the coast of Asia Minor and who were also mother worshippers. Much of Central Europe was thus early settled by these mixed types of the broad-headed white races, which practiced mother worship and the religious rite of cremating the dead, for it was the custom of the mother cultists to burn their dead in stone huts.
Okay, so another little tidbit besides how mother worship gets spread even further, and the fact that you've got missionaries from Crete and all that's pretty interesting stuff. But that whole bit about cremation, is getting spread by that. We'll see it next time as you're going, you don't suppose like the Northern Europeans, the way they wanted to, burn their dead?
Yeah,
they would have been in contact with the sea. It spreads. So even if they were kind of leaving the Andonites alone, they were picking up cultural things, including that little particular aspect of the mother cultists about cremation. And again, you see them, you were kind of wondering, it's like, well, okay, so we have all these Andonites penetrating. Are we then going to get, some Andite in there with them? Well, we already saw them talking about the pale skins. See, in a lot of ways, the Nodites really kind of made them a white race. Okay. I mean, obviously, you'll get some Andite, too. But that's kind of the interesting thing, is that in the same way you had a lot of Nodite in the Andites, the Nodites are feeding into the white races, a little less by first blending in with the Adamites and then, and then getting in there. They're kind of doing this a little bit more, the Nodites engaging the Andonites and that, being the kind of the root of the white race phenomenon there in Central Europe. So, again, the fact that, only, you know, only weird planets like us are going to have something like Nodites. you know, how many worlds can, you know, even talk about this sort of a predicate? Right? You know,
and Andonites.
Yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, not to mention the Andonites, which is not a very common thing either, a pre-Sangic will creature. So, yeah, we have a diversity on this planet that's not easy to find on worlds, you know, in this universe of universes. Okay, so the final section, now that they've given you all the kind of details, they're going to just give us this wonderful summary section to end this paper, which then rolls kind of naturally into the next paper, where we can think about you know, what you have in the earliest times there in Europe, what feeds into European civilization. And we saw hints of it, you know, when we were talking about northern and southern Italy. We'll see it, you know, in kind of in full force when we go to the next section. This is where it gets into the kind of things that humans were figuring out at the beginning of the 20th century that is now super politically incorrect. You know, the kind of stuff that scientists were working on in the, you know, first couple decades of the 20th century that then the Nazis picked up on and, you know, and ran off on tangents with. And all right, this is where, you know, you talk about a lot of material that, you know, the non-courageous on the planet are going to have a lot of problems with. So you know, we'll want to talk about that some next time. Make sure that everyone kind of understands an objective way to think about these issues. Because you might be confronted with someone who is quite honestly concerned that this is some sort of very, you know, problematic text that you're reading because of stuff like this. So you know, we'll talk about that quite a bit next time. All right, let's take a moment.
On a traditional color wheel, if you take such all these colors and combine them, not really like black and white, but red, yellow, blue, green, etc., they come up with an essential brown. And really, isn't that what we all are nowadays? And is an essential offshade of some variant of brown? That's how colors work.
We've been talking about that, you know, in previous weeks. That because of all the blending, you know, you don't have very definitive colored races anymore. But as I always say, if you start looking closely, you'll notice it isn't just white through shades of brown to black. There are still colors out there if you look closely. You know, it isn't so blended that you don't still see hints of colors if you look closely. Okay, let's take a moment here, everyone.